I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. There's been a lot of COVID-19 news in recent days. Tragically, U.S. deaths from the virus, more than 675,000 Americans, has topped the deaths from the 1918 flu epidemic. Here in Pennsylvania, 95% of hospitalizations and 97% of deaths are the unvaccinated, mirroring trends in other states. Pfizer announced this week that its COVID vaccine for children 5 to 11 shows great promise. The FDA will look at the data to see if it is safe and effective. Johnson & Johnson said their second dose of the vaccine provides more than 90% protection against COVID-19. Yesterday, the FDA voted in favor of the Pfizer COVID booster for those older than 65 and those with health risks. The CDC is meeting this week, probably today, to make their decision on the booster. We asked Dr. Paul Offit to join us. He's a member of the FDA's COVID Vaccine Advisory Panel, also director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and author of a new book titled You Bet Your Life, From Blood Transfusions to Mass Vaccination, The Long and Risky History of Medical Innovation, which we will discuss later in the show. Dr. Paul Offit, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be back. Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation. You can always send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Paul, you're a pediatrician, so let's start with this announcement by Pfizer that their vaccine, as far as they're concerned, is safe and effective for children as young as 5. The FDA is now taking a look at that. What specifically does the FDA look at?
Right, so we're sort of in an era of science by press release. You get this kind of one-page top-line summary of what Pfizer has found and would like you to know. I think what we're going to look at, hopefully, is the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee and then make a recommendation to the FDA is how did they come upon that dose? So the dose that we're currently giving to older adolescents and adults is 30 micrograms per dose as two separate doses. The dose here for the 5 to 11-year-old is 10 micrograms, again separated by 3 weeks as two doses. How did they come to that? Did they look at that smaller doses? Did they look at larger doses? Then I think the next question is safety, to look at every one of the children that got that vaccine to make sure that there were no worrisome side effects that may be seen when you go from thousands of children to millions of children. And then what the immunogenicity data were. Did the kind of immune responses that they saw correlate with what is likely to be protection against disease, and to what extent was it seen across everyone? In other words, did 85% of children have that response, 90%, 100%? So you want to look carefully at all that. It's an awesome responsibility.
Sure.
In the sense that you're just looking at thousands of people to try and make predictions about what will happen when it's in millions of people. And you know, that's an imperfect system.
Well, you were talking, as my understanding, is something like 2,300 children were part of this study. Obviously, some of them, got the vaccine and some of them got the placebo. How long does it take to look at them? And do you look at each and every single child to see their reaction?
Yeah, well, the FDA will. The FDA will have the primary data on every single child, and then they will put together a 50 to 100 page document that summarizes all of those data. In addition, we will be looking at usually a 50 to 100 page document that the sponsor or the company has submitted, and then we'll have that discussion and try and reach some kind of reasonable conclusion.
Do you have any sense of when that decision would come?
Well, one would hope that decision would come by no later than Halloween, hopefully earlier.
Oh, okay, that close. So about a month away. How different are, I understand children, they're not just little adults, but they are their own kind of human being. How different is their immune system?
Right, so there are, well, there, I would say, first of all, my daughter was 30 when she was 4, so
right.
I'm not sure they're not little adults, but there are certain differences. I mean, children less than 2 years of age don't make very good immune responses to this complex sugar that's on bacteria, so-called T-cell independent B-cell responses, which is why when you look at the Haemophilus influenza B vaccine or the pneumococcal vaccine or the meningococcal vaccine, those complex sugars are always complex to a harmless protein. Young babies don't make very good so-called neutrophilic responses, which is why they can be overwhelmed by bacterial infections. But for the most part, in the world of viruses, even when you're born, you make the kind of immune response that allows you to respond to these viral vaccines. Witness the hepatitis B vaccine, which is given at birth and is highly immunogenic.
Do we know, how about for even, Janice wants to know about even children younger than five, are they also sort of in the pipeline here?
Yes, and so they're in the midst of doing, Pfizer's in the midst of doing a study of six-month-olds to five-year-olds. There, the dosing schedule is 3 micrograms, so one-tenth of the dose that's being given now to adults. Again, it's 2 doses separated by 3 weeks, and we'll see what the data show.
I think what makes this such an urgent issue is obviously children largely are back in school. They are not vaccinated. Hopefully they're wearing masks and they're distancing and the ventilation in their classrooms are good, although we, you know, there's no guarantee of that. And we know that there are states where they're fighting putting those protective measures in. Just sort of weighing all the pros and cons, what should parents do if their children are in school?
Right. It's last year we were better at this. First of all, many public schools were closed last year. The private schools that had chosen to be open were very good about physically distancing children, wearing masks, and making sure the teachers wore masks, making sure that people, when they ate in cafeterias, were separated. This year we're not so good about that. I think just in general our behavior is not as good at trying to physical distance and mask and not have these large events. I mean, last year, you know, at an Eagles game, no one was there. This year, you know, there's 67,000 people at an Eagles game. So we're trying to put the pandemic behind us by, in some ways, in terms of our behavior, ignoring it. I think that there are some worrisome things. I mean, you have the Delta variant this year, which is clearly more transmissible than the Alpha variant was last year. You have children less than 12 years of age who are fully susceptible because they don't have a vaccine available to them yet. And for children who are, say, 12 to 15 years of age, only about 40% have actually received the vaccine, so they're an under-vaccinated population. And we're moving toward winter, where it's cooler and drier, and these kinds of viruses, like the SARS-CoV-2 virus, are much more easily spread in cooler, drier climates. So that's a bad combination of things.
Well, does it also say then the best way to protect children is for everyone else to get vaccinated, whether they're teenagers or adults?
Absolutely. I mean, if parents want to protect children, the number one most important thing they can do is to vaccinate themselves, vaccinate all with who can be vaccinated, who are going to be coming in contact with their children.
You mentioned about 40% of teenagers, and we know teenagers, you know, kind of think they can take risks and not have to pay the consequences. How specifically do we get more teenagers vaccinated? Less than 50% have one dose, but obviously they need 2 doses. Are there special ways to get teenagers more vaccinated?
Well, I think that when the virus first came into this country, you know, last February, only about 3% of the cases of the disease were seen in children. Now it's 27%. I mean, this is a childhood illness. You know, we had, in the past couple weeks, we've had between 200,000 cases a week and 250,000 cases a week. About 2,000 children are getting hospitalized every week. I can tell you, at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, we, consistent with the national average, are seeing far more children who are sick, and some of whom are very sick. And I guess one way I would try and convince parents to just have them round with us, as I did last week on service, and see just what COVID looks like in children when they're in the hospital. That would be convincing.
What does it look like?
Well, it's frightening. I mean, you know, some children struggle to breathe to the point that they may need to be ventilated, you know, put on an artificial respirator. And, you know, you look at the parents' faces as they're standing next to those children in anguish, because really, in the world of viral infections, there's nothing you really give that makes it go away. You just have to hope that the virus infection ultimately goes away on its own. I mean, you can treat bacterial infections with antibiotics, but by the time that a virus infection is so severe that you're in the hospital, usually antiviral medicines, like in this case, something like remdesivir, don't work. So what you end up doing is treating with steroids, like dexamethasone, which just suppresses the immune system, because the symptoms that you're seeing are all a consequence of the immune system. So it's very, very frustrating. You know, we're not there yet. We don't have the magic medicine that makes viruses disappear. Therefore, your best chance is to prevent it.
That's truly frightening. Are there certain children who appear to be at risk for contracting COVID-19?
Well, certainly obesity for older children
is
at least the single greatest risk factor, at least that we see in our hospital. So, yes, that's the big one.
And why obesity?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. There's something to do with the nature of the inflammatory response in children and adults who are obese that is somewhat more virulent than in those who are not obese. But I'm not sure why. I think that over the next year, as the years go here, we will learn more about this virus. We're learning as we go now. I remember when I was a fellow back in the in infectious disease back in the early 1980s, AIDS came into this country, and we were, again, learning as we go. Now our young fellows in our division are learning about SARS-CoV-2 virus and its treatment, and you know, things change as we get more information.
Anything else we need to know about children and this virus?
Initially, when the virus came into this country, probably 93% of the deaths were in people over 55. The epidemiology is changing. This virus is reaching down now into the vulnerable population of children. This is a childhood disease, and prevention is better than treatment. And so we need to, hopefully we'll get vaccines for children soon. And when we get them, we need to give them, because they don't work as a concept. They only work when you give them.
Let me ask you about the fact that the FDA, I guess it's an advisory committee. You disagreed with this, which is why I wanted to talk to you. This idea that the COVID-19 booster, I guess this has to do with Pfizer, should be given to people 65 and older and those who have some health risks. Where do you stand on this?
Yeah, I think this has been confusing for the general public and has not been communicated as clearly as it could be. Dr. Rochelle Walensky, who's the head of the CDC, has said repeatedly and correctly, the goal of this vaccine is to prevent serious illness, to keep people out of the hospital, out of the intensive care unit, out of the morgue. It's doing that. I mean, according to all of the studies that have been done in the United States, what you found is that the vaccine is highly effective at preventing severe disease for all age groups and in the Delta virus, and for the Delta virus, and for certainly both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So if that's true, why do we need a booster? And so then you sort of get to the second way to look at this. Let me say one other thing.
Sure.
The way that you're prevented from having serious illness is with an so-called immune memory cells, memory B cells, memory T cells. Those are usually long-lived, where you would expect to have protection against serious disease, frankly, for years. And that's what we're seeing currently. On the other hand, what happens with neutralizing antibodies is that they wane over time. That would have to happen, and it's happening to some extent here. And with the waning of neutralizing antibodies, then what you see is you can see an increased incidence of asymptomatic infection or mildly symptomatic infection. And associated with that, increased contagiousness. And I think that's where your people are coming down now. With regard to the greater than 65-year-old, I think they're put in the category, frankly, of an immune-compromised host, that as you get older, your immune system is less robust, more senescent. And so that was an easy decision. I think for the other groups, and you're going to see how the CDC decides on this by the end of the day, in terms of, you know, people who are at higher risk of more severe disease or people who work in settings where the virus is more easily transmitted, I think that also is going to be a recommendation. But frankly, if you look in hospitals and to see who's hospitalized or who's in the intensive care unit, it's not the people who need a third dose, it's people who haven't gotten any dose. And I think if we're going to get on top of this pandemic, the only way that's going to happen is if we vaccinate the unvaccinated. I'm curious to see what kind of impact on the arc of the pandemic there is associated with boosting the vaccinated.
Well, we have to take a very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Dr. Paul Offit about some of the latest developments in the fight against COVID-19. And we will be talking about his new book in a little bit. We got a lot of people in with a lot of questions here. His new book is titled You Bet Your Life, and it's about the often messy history of medical innovation. Dr. Offit is a member of the FDA's COVID Vaccine Advisory Panel and director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Let me just read a couple of comments here. One from Bill. Why are most children getting sick? Not most children, but why are so many children getting sick now? Is it because the Delta variant is different or just that they are more exposed?
Well, I think it's a few things. It's certainly true that the Delta variant is far more transmissible. And I think you probably need lesser time in contact with someone who is infected to get infected. Whereas I think with the viruses that were somewhat less transmissible, you needed a greater time of contact to get sick. Secondly, you know, they're a vulnerable population, and this virus is now finding out or reaching down to the groups that are the most susceptible. Most people, or something like in the 80+% range of people, say over 65, are already vaccinated, so that's a less vulnerable group. And I think our behavior's different. We were much more careful about children last year at this time than we are now. It seems somehow just the notion that there is a vaccine makes us feel that we can then loosen things up and go back to life as normal. But as we're finding, we can't. I mean, our numbers now in terms of hospitalizations and deaths on a weekly basis is worse than it was last September, which is remarkable considering that last September we had a fully susceptible population and no vaccine. And I think the big difference is our behavior.
Well, are you saying that children then should go back to remote learning, that they should not be in the classroom?
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that it is really important for children to go back to school for so many reasons.
Right.
I think on-site learning is so much better than remote learning, and for children in Philadelphia, for many, it's the only decent meal they get during the day. Child abuse is often picked up in school. Socialization, obviously, is critical for children. I think they've suffered more than any other. But that's why that makes going back to school so precious, and I think that's why we should handle it as something precious, meaning we should do exactly what we did last year when we didn't have a vaccine and make sure all the teachers are vaccinated, make sure that all the children wear a mask, make sure we can, you know, physically distance as much as we can when children aren't wearing a mask in the cafeteria. And we should treat it just like we did last year, because frankly, for children under 12, they're just as vulnerable as they were last year, and arguably more vulnerable since this Delta variant is so transmissible.
Is every staff member at CHOP, are they vaccinated?
So CHOP has a vaccine mandate that will be firmly in place by mid-October. So that's the goal. Yes.
Let me ask you, and we got a lot of questions here, but let me just toss something in here that I was reading about having to do with testing and rapid testing. Apparently in Britain, in France, and Germany, they do antigen testing. It's, you know, you can get a quick response whether a child, since we're talking about children, you know, tests positive for COVID. We do PCR testing in this country. We don't, at least as I understand yet, have rapid home testing. How important is that? And would that help us at least stay a little bit ahead of this virus?
It's important, and it would help us stay ahead of this virus. I mean, my sister actually lives in London, and what she gets is she gets this batch of home antigen testing kits that's free to her.
It's free. Wow.
It's free. And she... you know, and I think the advantage of the antigen test as compared to the PCR test is it generally correlates better with actual shedding of infectious virus. I mean, the PCR test tests for genome, you know, the virus genes, whereas the antigen test actually tests for the protein of the virus, which is a little closer to the likelihood that the virus is actually reproducing itself and making whole virus particles. No, I think it would be very helpful to have that. Right now, testing in this country is often difficult to get and sporadic, whereas a home antigen kit, I think, would help a lot.
So why don't we have it? I mean, it's, you know, there it is, right? And apparently it's more effective than what we have or what we're doing now.
Yes, definitely more effective. Actually, when my sister was here, I borrowed a bunch or stole a bunch of antigen kits, which we now have in our house.
But, I mean, this is a serious question, because I feel like, you know, if we have some tools to make, you know, life safer and healthier for people in this country, what prevents us from doing that?
Well, you know, you could ask that at every stage of this pandemic, why we didn't do things differently. I don't know. I certainly wish we would. I certainly feel that the Biden administration is committed to doing the right things in the right way. It's just, I think, we just have a lot of catching up to do.
I mean, is it that, or is it there something about the bureaucracy, either at the FDA, you're a member of the FDA's COVID vaccine advisory panel, or the CDC, that's just not agile enough to respond?
Well, the FDA has licensed a home antigen kit that one could have. It's just a matter of but now you have to buy it, and I'm not sure people really know about it. Mm-hmm. So I think that would it be a value for the government here to do what the government in the United Kingdom is doing and provide free home antigen testing? Yes. You could argue, actually, that would have more of an impact on this pandemic than giving a third dose.
Really? Really? So is it a messaging problem?
Yes, I think we've suffered a communications problem in many aspects of this pandemic, and not the least of which is calling a mild or asymptomatic infection a breakthrough infection. I mean, that, I think, sent the message that the vaccine's not working when it's working well. That's, you want the vaccine to protect you against serious illness, and it continues to do that. And I think even just by sending the message that we need a third dose also sent the message that people aren't protected, whereas they are protected against serious disease, at least for all the data that we have up to through August.
Let me read some comments, and then I do want to move on to some other issues as well. This is from Paul. He says, I know someone who got the Pfizer shot in the spring, the J&J shot in July. What are your thoughts on mixing the vaccines, Paul?
Well, we need more data. It's interesting that there was just a study that was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine looking at the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is similar to the J&J vaccine in that it's a vectored virus vaccine. And what they did was they took people and either gave them a second dose of that vectored virus vaccine, the AstraZeneca vaccine, or they gave them an mRNA vaccine. So they essentially mixed then the two doses. And what they found was is that those who'd gotten the mRNA vaccine actually had a much higher neutralizing antibody titer response and more importantly, had a much broader response against sort of all the variants that are currently being identified. So, I mean, those are the kind of data that we need to generate in order to answer the questions people have. Hopefully today at the ACIP meeting, when they decide on booster dosing, they won't only make a decision about what to do with regard to the Pfizer vaccine, but also at least help provide some guidelines for people who've received two doses of the Moderna vaccine or one dose of the J&J vaccine so we don't leave them out in the cold.
Yeah, high and dry. Here's a question from Fred. He says, I'm in my 90s. I've had three Pfizer shots without any side effects. Does that indicate I do not have a proper response? I did not have a proper response and therefore not as protected. It's funny because I got the two Pfizer shots and I was fine. I had no reaction. And I had the same question to myself was, am I supposed to have some kind of reaction once you get one of these shots?
Well, so if you look at the data from the phase three studies, you know, where tens of thousands of people were either given the vaccine or given placebo, you looked at the side effect profile with the first and second dose. You saw that with the second dose, there were, you know, 50% of people would have fever, headache, joint pain, muscle pain, et cetera. But that was 50%. Nonetheless, there was 95% protection against all manner of illness for all age groups. So I think you should just consider yourself lucky.
Here's a question from Margaret. What studies have been done to look at naturally acquired versus vaccination required antibodies? And Paul, this has come up a number of times when we talk about COVID.
Right. So when the studies were done, looking at the Pfizer vaccine or the Moderna vaccine or the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, they would compare the antibody response, the neutralizing antibody response, to those who had been naturally infected. And what they found generally is that the antibody response, neutralizing antibody response generated after vaccination was basically in the upper quartile of what was seen after natural infection, suggesting that at least vaccination was at least on par, if not better, than natural infection. Now, there was one study that came out of Israel that made the case that natural infection provided better and longer lasting immunity than did vaccination. But that was one study, and it really has not necessarily been our experience here in the United States. So I would say that natural infection does protect against serious disease associated with re-exposure to the mm-hmm. virus. So I think one should feel happy that they've survived their natural infection and know that they have a reasonable amount of immunity following that.
Should they also get a vaccine on top of that as a kind of insurance policy?
Right. So there was a study done in Kentucky where they looked at people who'd been naturally infected and then gotten a booster dose or doses of an mRNA vaccine as compared to people who were naturally infected and then not boosted. And what they found was that those who were given then the vaccine following natural infection, there was a 2.5-fold lesser risk of getting infected subsequently than those who weren't given essentially a booster dose.
So taking that, can we anticipate that at some point between people being vaccinated and those who have tested positive for this COVID-19 or whatever variant we're going to be dealing with, that we will eventually get on top of this pandemic?
I think the key to getting on top of this pandemic is vaccinating the unvaccinated. We have a solid 60, 65 million people in this country who just are refusing to be vaccinated, basically saying we want to remain fertile ground for the spread of this virus, and what are you going to do about it? And we're trying. I think that's where the mandates come in. In a better world, we wouldn't need mandates. In a better world, people would look at the data and see that you are far more likely to be hospitalized and die if you're unvaccinated than if you're vaccinated, and that the vaccine is is safe. It's not absolutely safe, but no medical product is absolutely safe, and that you would get the vaccine. I couldn't wait to get the vaccine. I consider myself knowledgeable about these vaccines. I couldn't wait to get vaccinated. You know, it's just like that scene in Jaws, you know, if you remember this movie where, you know, the Robert Shaw, the captain, was saying the worst time he had when he was, you know, delivering the bomb, and then his ship was sunk and he was in the ocean and the sharks were starting to eat people. And the worst time was waiting actually for that helicopter to come pick him up while he was watching, you know, this all happening, that because there was a rescue that was right there, but it hadn't come to him yet. That's the way I felt about this vaccine. You know, while others were getting, I couldn't wait to get that vaccine. And I finally got it by the end of December.
Well, you and me both. That's Dr. Paul Offit, our guest on Radio Times. Today, he's a member of the FDA's COVID Vaccine Advisory Panel, also director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And he's got a new book. It's called You Bet Your Life, with a long subtitle, From Blood Transfusions to Mass Vaccination, The Long and Risky History of Medical Innovation. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I said in my introduction that here in Pennsylvania, 95% of people hospitalized for COVID are unvaccinated. 97% of deaths are from people who are unvaccinated. Why does that message of the risks of not being vaccinated, why does that not penetrate when it comes to people who just refuse to be vaccinated?
I don't know. I think what's certainly the notion of kind of anti-vaccine pushback, if you will, is not new. I mean, it's as old as the first vaccine. I think what's different about this vaccine and this virus, near as I could tell, is the political nature of this. I mean, typically, there wasn't a politics to the anti-vaccine movement. On the left, if you will, it was more the sort of all things natural, don't inject me with anything in my body. I just want to, you know, I just want to have an all natural setting and don't put foreign agents in my body. On the right, it was a libertarian, you know, government off my back. That seems to dominate now. It's this sort of notion of personal freedom. Don't tell me what to do. But it's really not a personal freedom. It's not a civil liberty to catch and transmit a potentially fatal infection. It's not a decision you're making for yourself. It's a decision you're making for others. I mean, if I choose not to get a tetanus vaccine and get tetanus, that's a personal decision. No one's going to catch tetanus from me. It's not a contagious illness. This is a contagious illness, and it's not your right to transmit it to other people who either can't be vaccinated because they're immune suppressed or haven't been vaccinated yet because they're children. You know, you have a responsibility living in this society to act like a member of this society and treat your neighbor well.
You write in this book, and you have some criticisms about the FDA and how it handled the COVID-19 threat last year. There was a time in which it actually approved hydroxychloroquine. As you write, it really hadn't been thoroughly tested, but nonetheless, you know, they gave it the green light. There was a time when Dr. Fauci said you don't need to wear a mask. I mean, I think he was talking more about the mask shortage for people who were on the front lines of the pandemic. But nonetheless, were there some missteps coming from the government, even beyond Trump, former President Trump, that you think set the stage for where we are now?
Well, sure. I think there were a number of missteps. I think we could have closed the borders, especially from travel from Asia, much more quickly. I mean, there were hundreds of thousands of people who came in before we ever really closed the border. Two is we were pretty slow to make a test to see who was infected and who wasn't. We put that all in the hands of the CDC, where it should have been really distributed to many other companies that could have done that more quickly. I think we could have, you know, we're quarantined. And as I think our behavior is probably the most powerful thing we can do here, even more powerful than masking, more powerful than mandates is our behavior in this. There's a book called Premonition by Michael Lewis that goes through that story about how that is the most powerful thing that you can do. So sure, there were missteps. I think Dr. Fauci has done a remarkable job. Hopefully I never criticize him in my book, but
No, you don't. I mean, I was thinking of all the things that were said that now, and your book is in part that, you know, we learn along the way. Sometimes we make mistakes. Sometimes they're just things that just happen because we don't know enough to know exactly what we're dealing with.
That's right. I think, and that's the nature of science. As more data become available, the recommendations may change. But I think for many people, the fluidity of that is disconcerting. I mean, the notion that a scientist could take a textbook and throw it over their shoulder without a backward glance as more and more information gets available is disconcerting. And so we look to gurus, you know, who you know, sort of are immutable, who just are sure of everything all the time, when in fact anybody who's cognizant of science and medicine will know that things change, and that I know. But I think the sort of most humorous phrase that people say to me is when they say they're fully informed. I'm not fully informed. I mean, you know, you're never really fully informed because you're always learning.
So I mean, and I'm tossing things at you. You may not be able to answer. So why does someone choose ivermectin over something like the COVID vaccine?
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean,
it's
horse deworming agent that people choose without any evidence that it works, with plenty of evidence that it has serious intestinal side effects. There was actually a 3 or 4 minute spoof of ivermectin that's currently going viral on YouTube, but it ends with the phrase, ask your large animal veterinarian whether ivermectin is right for you.
I mean, we can make fun of people that do that, but do you think that's helpful?
To make fun of people who do that? No. I think, you know, you would like to think in a better world that reason and logic dominate. But I think, as Neil deGrasse Tyson say, if people reach a conclusion without using reason or logic, then reason or logic isn't going to talk them out of it. And certainly making fun of them isn't going to talk them out of it. I agree with all of that. And so if there is no talking them out of it, and they continue to be fertile ground for the spread of the virus, then I think you just have to force play. To me, the most interesting thing is that if you look at a state like Mississippi, Mississippi is one of the least vaccinated states. It's sort of, in the last time I looked, it was in the mid-30% range, which is why they have a fair amount of hospitalization and death, and their ICUs are being overrun. The answer to the question, what state in this country has the highest rate of vaccination in children? It's Mississippi, 99%. The reason is that they have never had a philosophical or religious exemption to vaccination. Or said another way, you can compel people to do the right thing.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Dr. Paul Offit. He is, as I mentioned several times, a member of the FDA's COVID Vaccine Advisory Panel. He's also director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Also a co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine, and he's got a new book, You Bet Your Life. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Do stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking today on the show with Dr. Paul Offit about some of the latest developments in the fight against COVID-19. He's got a new book, which we have been doing some sporadic questions about. It's called You Bet Your Life, and it's about the often messy history of medical innovation. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to talk about risk, but let me just toss a question from Dave. He said, I read that lots of people are refusing to get vaccinated and are instead getting monoclonal antibody treatment, which is far more expensive. Who is paying for that? It doesn't seem right. What do we need to know, Paul, about monoclonal antibodies and how they work?
Right. So I think monoclonal antibodies work very well if given at the beginning of illness, before you are sick enough to have been hospitalized. But you shouldn't be getting monoclonal antibodies anyway, meaning not ill and just want that as sort of temporary passive immunity. I mean, those monoclonal antibodies will protect you for about 3 months, and then you're not protected anymore. So I think monoclonal antibodies in many ways are underused as a treatment early in infection, but again, certainly are no substitute for vaccination.
Here's a question from Margo. What's your advice on flu shots for kids thinking about COVID and that vaccine approval could be coming? When is a good time to get the flu shot?
Right. Well, now, you know, the flu vaccines are now available, have been since the beginning of September. What I do worry about, and I think it's implied in the question, is now we're going to see flu this year, influenza. We didn't see it last year.
Right.
Normally about 75 to 150 children die every year from influenza. Last year, one child died of influenza, which tells you that if you shut down schools, shut down business, and restrict travel, that you can decrease the spread of respiratory viruses. That's not true this year. So you're going to see influenza, you're going to see respiratory syncytial virus, you're going to see human coronaviruses and other viral respiratory infections in concert with SARS-CoV-2. So I think it's all the more important to get a flu vaccine. What I would say is if you can, I would separate the flu vaccine from, you know, the SARS-CoV-2 vaccines by about 2 weeks. So you're not getting them at the same time.
I mean, it sounds like you're describing, for all the reasons that we've been talking about, a tougher winter, COVID-related winter for us.
I'm worried about that. I am, especially for children, because they're right now utterly susceptible if you're less than 12 years of age, and generally the 12 to 15-year-old is under-vaccinated. I do worry about that. It is at its heart a winter virus.
Let me talk to you about risk. And you write about that in your book, about how we understand risk, how we assess risk, I think how we personalize risk. As a researcher and a physician yourself, what is a helpful way to think about risk when it comes to things like vaccinations or other medical treatments that we often need?
Well, that there are no risk-free choices. I mean, there's just choices to take different risks. A choice not to get a vaccine, for example, in this pandemic, is not a choice to just avoid some of the risks associated with vaccination, but it's a choice to entertain the real risks of getting infected and what can happen if you're infected. I think what I tried to do in the book was to take these sort of nine major medical advances that have caused us to live 30 years longer than we did 100 years ago and just start from the beginning and then sort of stop and say, okay, well, how about now? So for blood transfusions, for example, you know, a couple hundred years ago, we used farm animals as our source of blood that we would transfuse into humans. All right, would you get it now? Well, now we know that the answer would be no, because we didn't know about blood typing. Okay, so now you know about sort of ABO blood typing. Would you get it now in the early 1900s? But we still didn't know about, for example, the so-called Rh factor. Like if you're O positive, it's that positive that's Rh factor. Okay, so would you get it now? Well, we still didn't know about, for example, diseases like hepatitis B or hepatitis C, which would contaminate the blood. So, okay, now we know about that. Would you get it now? Then AIDS comes into the country and HIV contaminates the blood supply. All right, would you get it now? And, you know, and even up to the current day, there are viruses for which we don't test in whole blood, and there are viruses we don't know about. So would you consider being one of the first to try artificial blood, which is being tested? I mean, so, and it's, you know, and if, or if you're, you know, if you're awaiting a heart transplant and you're one of the 4,000 people awaiting a heart transplant, knowing that about 1,300 will die while waiting, would you be willing to be one of the first to try a pig heart as a transplant? It's always a matter of learning as we go, and the question is never when do you know everything, it's when do you know enough, and that's it. It's about trying to make a clear-eyed, dispassionate decision about whether or not you should entertain a particular therapy, and I try and go through all of these different scenarios to help formulate that question better.
Humans are not known for being clear-eyed and dispassionate, especially about their health or, let's say, the health of their children or their loved ones.
Yeah, I think that's an understatement. We tend to make decisions based on more emotion than anything else. I think it's because our amygdala and hippocampus, which were far better developed when we crawled out of the ocean onto land, than our cerebrum, which was late to the game. So I still think we're sort of wired to run away from larger animals.
Let me ask you about the polio vaccine. I'm old enough to remember getting the polio vaccine back in the 1950s. And you remind us, as you write about it, that Jonas Salk, the very first vaccine, actually gave children polio.
Yeah, there were a couple things in that story that I found interesting. The first is, so Jonas Salk was a hero, right? He took poliovirus, he grew it up in cell culture, he purified it, he inactivated it with the chemical, and he felt he had the vaccine. Well, five companies mass-produced that vaccine. One of them made it badly, Cutter Laboratories of Berkeley, California. They failed to fully inactivate poliovirus. As a consequence, 120,000 children, this was 1955, were inadvertently inoculated with live fully virulent poliovirus. As a consequence, about 40,000 developed abortive or short-lived polio, meaning short-lived paralysis. 164 were permanently paralyzed for the rest of their life, and 10 were killed. I think it's probably one of the worst biological disasters in American history. Imagine if something like that happened now. The second story there, and this sort of relates to today in many ways, that trial of his vaccine, the so-called Francis Field trial, broke his heart. I mean, when he had made his vaccine and tested it in 700 people in the Pittsburgh area, he found that it was safe and highly immunogenic. He couldn't conscience the trial of his vaccine that was about to be done, where 420,000 children got vaccine, 200,000 got placebo, salt water. He couldn't conscience giving 200,000 children salt water coming into the summer season when he knew polio was going to ravage children. And so the vaccine was declared safe and effective. And it was. Well, how do we know it was effective? We knew it was effective because 16 children died in that study, all in the from polio, all in the placebo group. We knew it was effective because 36 children were paralyzed in that study by poliovirus. 34 were in the placebo group. That's how we knew it was effective. That's the price we paid for knowledge. And that's always the balance. When do you know enough?
I understand what you're saying, but I can also imagine someone listening to that story and saying, yeah, even though that was, 60, 70 years ago, that mistakes were made and children paid the price. And do I trust the FDA? And, you know, can I believe what Dr. Paul Offit is telling me?
Right. We'll use a modern day example. So when the Pfizer did their 12 to 15 year old study, it was in roughly 2,300 children, 2,360 children. So roughly 1,200 children got vaccine, 1,200 children got placebo. There were 18 cases of COVID in that study, all in the placebo group. So I got emails, angry emails from people, because I'm on the FDA Vaccine Advisory Panel. I got angry emails from people saying, 2,300 children, that's it? You tested in 44,000 people as an adult, and for children you tested in 2,300 children? And so my response to that was, do you think we should have tested it in 23,000 children? In which case there would have been 180 cases of COVID in the placebo group, or virtually all in the placebo group. At what price knowledge? Where do we draw the line? When do we know enough? Because you never know everything. When do you know enough to move forward, which is really sort of the basis of the book?
Well, and you begin the book by just underscoring the fact that we live in a time of extraordinary medical innovation.
Exactly. And I think we are very quick to pat ourselves on the back for you know, what have been these nine major medical advances, which is why I wanted to go through each of those stories to show how even up to the modern day, there are things that we're learning that we were surprised by. Gene therapy, for example, there were French researchers who used a retrovirus vector to try and provide a gene to children who lacked a particular gene, and they found that because they used that particular vector, it happened to insert itself right into a part of the DNA that actually ended up causing a stimulation of a gene that caused leukemia in 3 of 10 children. And that was just recently. So we are always learning as we go. We think we're in this modern age where we know everything, but you never know everything.
There's a really colorful story in here about anesthesia, and apparently I don't know if he was a carnival barker or worker, a guy named Gardner Cotton, and he used to, you could go to the carnival, you pay your 25 cents, you get to sniff laughing gas, and you would laugh your head off, and then you'd fall asleep. And as you write, there was a dentist that saw this act and tried it and had a kind of aha moment. What happened?
Right. He went up on stage, he tried this laughing gas, he sort of made a fool of himself, passed out, but he was out. And when he got back to his seat, he saw that there was blood on his pants and realized that he'd hurt himself, but felt nothing. And he said to himself that, I think this is what I could do for tooth extractions. And that was the birth of anesthesia. That was nitrous oxide.
And you write about William Morton. He used ether. I guess there were some limitations to that, right?
Right, not the least of which was its flammability, and it was safe. But you know, there were doctors who, for example, would cauterize a wound, meaning take this small flame and cauterize a wound, and at the same time that ether was being done, where they would catch on fire. There was actually a TV show called The Nick, which was on Showtime, took place at this sort of fictional 1906 hospital called the Knickerbocker, and they actually had a scene like that where this doctor just ignited himself and ultimately died. It was a dramatic scene, and it was true. I mean, that was a real story.
And there was chloroform, I guess. I don't know, is that still used now?
No. I mean, chloroform had the problem of liver toxicity, which could be fatal. So, no, chloroform is not used. Not in any important way. No.
Looking ahead and sort of, I guess, sort of where we are today, then, how do you see this pandemic proceeding? And this would be in America. And I do want to talk about the rest of the world because we are all interconnected. But how do you see it progressing, especially over the next, let's say, 6 months in this country?
Well, so if you look at states like Massachusetts, Vermont, Connecticut, that have fairly high immunization rates, they have low rates of hospitalization and death, which tells you that at least the two-dose vaccine, if broadly applied, can dramatically lessen the hit from this pandemic. When you look at the 10 sort of low-use states, where you're in the sort of low 40% range for immunization, there the virus thrives. So what that teaches me is that that we have a ticket out of this, and the ticket out of this is a vaccine, but we need to give it. And I just think the what we need is we need about 90% population immunity, either from vaccination or immunization or both. There's probably, although it's reported that about 42 million Americans have been infected, that's low. When you do antibody surveillance studies, it's at least 100 million people. Uh-huh. And we know that, whatever, roughly 53% of the total population has been vaccinated. If you add it up, and obviously those are not two separate groups because there are people who've been vaccinated and naturally infected and vice versa. So we're probably at about 75% population immunity. I think we need to get to about 90% population immunity. I think we need to vaccinate at least another 40 million people, even though there's about 65 million people out there. Get to about 40 million more people vaccinated, and I think we can dramatically curb this. The problem is there's an unequal distribution of that 75%. We're in the southeastern states have a lesser population immunity.
Are there countries that are at that 90% that you know?
Ireland. Yeah, Ireland is getting there, yeah, and has, because there was a fellow who trained in our division who I talked to a couple of weeks ago, and she said, we have high immunization rates because, she said, and I'll quote, we see this as that we're all in this together, and I just don't think we see it that way.
There are other countries in the world, some African countries, where, it's single digits, the number of people who are vaccinated against COVID. President Biden talked yesterday about the U.S. distributing more vaccines around the world. How significant is that?
Well, it's critical. I mean, you this virus, although you would never know it from seeing the media, but it's actually a slow mutator. It's not like flu. But we have had now three major variants. The first one came out of China, not the original Wuhan strain. The first strain that came out of China was a so-called D614G variant. That's the one that killed about 200,000 people in this country. Then that was replaced by the Alpha variant. That's been replaced by the Delta variant. So this virus mutates. But I'm sorry, the original question there.
It was about the rest of the world, making sure that these countries low vaccination rates. Yeah,
right.
Go ahead.
I mean, so Delta was first isolated in India. The Alpha variant was first isolated in the UK. So what happens in the rest of the world clearly affects us. And, you have 195 countries in this world, many of which haven't given a single dose of vaccine. Mm-hmm. And it's not an altruistic act to give vaccine to the developing world because we have the technology and we have the resources to make a lot of vaccine. And we're ending up throwing away a lot of vaccine because it expires. We should do everything we can to vaccinate the world because that protects the world. And also, I mean, look at the polio vaccine. We continue to give a polio vaccine in this country. We haven't seen a case of polio in this country since the late 1970s. The reason we give a polio vaccine is it still exists in Afghanistan. It still exists in Pakistan. And this virus is obviously far worse than that.
You think we're going to get to that 90%?
Yes. Well, one way or the other. I think we're going to get to that 90% population immunity, either because we've been vaccinated or naturally infected. But there was a researcher at NIH, I think, who said it well. He said that in the next few years, you're going to have two choices, and that's either be vaccinated or be naturally infected.
Wow. Wow. And, not to pour cold water on our conversation, is there another virus that's just sort of waiting to get us?
Well, this is our third pandemic potential virus in the last 20 years. I mean, first it was SARS-1, then it was MERS, now it's this virus. Do I think that it's likely that there'll be another one in the next 10, 20 years? Yes.
We got to leave it there. Dr. Paul Offit, as always, thank you for joining us on Radio Times. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, he's got a new book. It's called You Bet Your Life, From Blood Transfusions to Mass Vaccination, The Long and Risky the long and risky history of medical innovation. And again, he is a member of the FDA's COVID Vaccine Advisory Panel and director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. We've got a lot of COVID shows there that you can check out. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.